Imagine waking up one day and realizing you've spent your entire life preparing for, engaging in, or recovering from work. This is the startling revelation at the heart of David Frayn's The Refusal of Work. While our society has achieved unprecedented productivity levels, we paradoxically work longer hours than medieval peasants. The first question we ask strangers remains, "What do you do?" as if employment defines our very humanity. Politicians across the spectrum obsess over job creation while stigmatizing those who don't work as scroungers. But what if this work-centered worldview is neither natural nor inevitable? What if our collective worship of employment has become a trap that constrains human potential rather than fulfilling it? The book challenges us to question why, despite technological advances that could free us from drudgery, we remain chained to our desks, factories, and service counters. It explores how work has colonized not just our time, but our very identities, and examines the stories of ordinary people who've dared to imagine and create lives less dominated by employment. Work wasn't always seen as virtuous. In Genesis, it was a divine punishment. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food. Ancient Greeks viewed work as beneath free citizens, with Aristotle arguing it corrupted both body and mind. Our modern work ethic emerged with industrial capitalism's need to motivate factory labor. Religious reformers framed work as a divine calling, while industrialists tied productivity to moral character. Factory bells, time cards, and supervision introduced unprecedented forms of control. This history reveals a key insight. Our current system of 40-plus hour work weeks and year-round employment isn't natural law, but a historical development. Medieval peasants worked less than modern employees, and hunter-gatherers spent just hours daily on survival tasks. The issue isn't productive activity, which can be fulfilling, but rather how paid employment dominates modern life. Despite work's cultural sanctity, many experience their jobs as exhausting and meaningless activities done purely out of necessity. While Western economies have shifted from industrial to service models, this hasn't improved work quality. Instead, technology has been used to enforce unprecedented levels of control. Amazon warehouse workers describe themselves as machines held to unrealistic metrics by handheld computers. Call center employees face constant monitoring, with software tracking every word and break. Even in professional settings, work has become more intense and invasive rather than fulfilling. A new form of alienation has emerged, one that exploits rather than excludes human qualities. Service workers must manufacture emotions to please customers, while retail employees follow scripted friendliness under constant surveillance. As one philosopher notes, communication has lost its gratuitous, pleasurable contact to become economic necessity, a joyless fiction. The ultimate irony, as work increasingly demands our authentic selves, our emotions, creativity, and personalities, it simultaneously commodifies these very human qualities. Have you ever bought appliances you never use or scrolled through vacation photos of places you barely experienced? These are symptoms of work colonizing our entire existence, not just our office hours. The modern workday splinters our time, leaving little room for meaningful, self-directed activities. The typical worker, commuting home with pending emails and depleted energy, can barely engage with family, exemplifying how work degrades our leisure time. Digital technology has worsened this invasion, with network devices erasing traditional boundaries. Workers must remain perpetually available, as being on vacation is no longer an acceptable excuse. In today's uncertain economy, maintaining employability becomes a constant pursuit that subordinates life enjoyment to market demands. This mentality runs so deep that even children absorb it, like the 12-year-old who valued an anti-smoking program for its CV potential. Unlike traditional work hour exploitation, the drive for employability requires continuous self-monitoring as work and life boundaries blur, creating a society where free time merely serves to prepare us for more work. Larry watched his social work career devolve from meaningful client engagement to mere paperwork. Matthew, a philosophy graduate, dreaded jobs requiring artificial cheerfulness. These are just two of the individuals Frayn interviewed who reached their limits with employment. Their resistance often emerged as sudden realizations, what they called taking life off autopilot or waking from a long sleep. Many criticized colleagues who accepted their circumstances without question. The breaking points varied. Some witnessed meaningful work become standardized and stripped of autonomy. Others experienced brief periods of freedom, often during university, that made traditional employment feel intolerable afterward. Some resisted for survival. Bruce, a former mental health worker, described the day his body broke. "I literally just broke. I started to get all these pains and spasms. I couldn't sleep." He saw these symptoms as his body signaling enough is enough. These accounts show that work resistance stems not from ideology, but from direct experience, when work fails to provide promised meaning, security, and well-being. Isn't it depressing not being able to buy things? This question reveals our assumption that reducing work means sacrifice. Yet participants like Samantha, an attorney-turned-waitress, saw their choice as massively indulgent, contrasting her freedom with former colleagues who were knackered from long hours and poor work-life balance. Working less helped participants discover rare pleasures, spontaneity, slowness, and self-reliance. They found renewed intimacy with partners, rediscovered cooking and shared meals, and embraced simple joys like reading, gardening, and conversation. This reflects philosopher Kate Soper's alternative hedonism, recognizing that affluent lifestyles often create unhappiness through stress, pollution, and social isolation. Participants distinguished between outward people, materialistic, status-conscious, and inward people, valuing time, relationships, growth, echoing Fromm's having versus being modes. Working less allowed them to find satisfaction through self-reliance, learning repairs, cooking, and crafting that offered both practical value and fulfillment. What do you do? Creates anxiety for work resistors like Bruce, who called it the dreaded question. The stigma of joblessness excludes the unemployed from full social acceptance. Beyond work-life balance, which burdens individuals with managing work demands, we need what Andre Gorz called a politics of time, collective decisions about work distribution to enable greater freedom. Shorter working hours would reduce unemployment by spreading necessary work across the population. The goal is transforming society so work isn't the sole source of income, rights, and belonging. Free time should transcend mere recovery from work, allowing pursuit of self-directed activities. We must embrace utopian thinking despite its dismissal. While work provides vital benefits, social connection, income, status, these shouldn't depend on submission to exploitative, environmentally harmful, and scarce employment. In our era of unprecedented productivity, we have the technological means to work less. What we lack is cultural and political will. The question isn't whether we can afford to work less, but whether we can afford not to reimagine work before it consumes life's essence.